This is the Friends of History Debating Society. I'm Gaius, John Batchelor. Germanicus is here, Michael Vlahos. And Ukraine, there's news. NATO, there's news. Cambridge 5, there's news. We begin with Ukraine. A very good evening to you, Germanicus. We are in Londinium. It is milder now, coming May, soon enough. In Londinium, 91 AD, all is peaceful in the kingdom by the sea. We are Roman Britons, mostly Romans, very far from Rome, not worried about our politics at all. The tribes of Britain have been quelled or bought off mostly. That is the way we late Romans do things. Conquer first, buy second. However, we're looking into the 21st century where there's trouble with the future Roman Empire. That would be the United States of America and its surrogate allies. And we begin with the news from Ukraine because that package has finally been passed by the U.S. Congress. However, a good evening to you, Germanicus. Ukraine defeat would cost the West trillions of dollars, says the former armed forces minister in Britain. And Ukraine's battlefield position has worsened, the Army Chief of Staff of Ukraine admits. And Ukrainian drones strike oil refineries and airfield in major overnight attack. And this one, why should I return to fight, Ukrainian men living abroad say, adding, Poland could deport Ukrainians for conscription. A very good evening to you, Germanicus. I would say that the package from the United States, including ATACMS and other high-end weapon systems, are a plus. However, the news that the front is worsening, that is, collapsing, and that Poland is entertaining the idea of deporting Ukrainian draft-age men, suggests that the weapons are not going to be enough to secure the front lines. A very good evening to you, Germanicus.
Good evening, Gaius. The weapons package, as a weapons package, is a morale booster. It is window dressing, essentially. The itemized list of instruments that we are going to deliver to Ukraine has no numbers alongside them. And most of the items are in themselves not sufficient to help Ukraine achieve what is most urgent for the Ukrainian army right now, and that is to find some defensible position that it can hold against the Russians. And what is happening now, I know we've talked recently about the last 9 months of the American Civil War and how the Confederacy, especially the last real working army, the Army of Northern Virginia, was ground down over a long siege and the field works around that stretched from Richmond to Petersburg. And that attrition did in the Confederacy, of course. But what we're seeing now in terms of battlefield dynamics along the front is really more akin to the period in the early autumn of 1918, starting in late September and ending, of course, with the armistice. But during that two-month period, the Allies were literally conducting a rolling advance. And when I say rolling, I mean on foot. So the gains day by day were not huge, but as the Germans were pushed out of their very well-tended and well-constructed main defense line, the Hindenburg line, they really had nowhere to sit down and hold the line. And this is exactly the problem that is gathering steam right now after being pushed out of Avdiivka and, of course, Bakhmut and these other anchors that were built after 2014 in the Donbas. The Ukrainian army is not in a position to stop a rolling Russian advance, and the attrition is huge. And added to the attrition are the number of soldiers surrendering every day. Yesterday, it was hundreds who surrendered because they had been encircled. And so you're beginning to see a slow rolling coming apart of the Ukrainian army at the front. And a good barometer of the intensity of the curve of that coming apart, how it is accelerating, can be best gauged, if not measured, by the number of prisoners taken every day. And that was certainly true in October of 1918. And it is this situation that has the Allies, meaning essentially NATO, or the EU and the US, however you want to characterize it, the Allies know that there isn't much time left. And little eruptions, policy eruptions, like the Poles saying, oh, we're going to send back draft age men who sought asylum in Poland. And the US apparently was the main force that pushed Kiev to get the mobilization law passed. And it was passed with only 1/10 of the RADA members being physically present, hardly a quorum. In other words, the U.S. insisted that Ukraine enter into that desperate territory where their losses will only accelerate, and that Ukraine is essentially being pushed to sacrifice itself at an ever-accelerating rate. Now, that is not enough, as we discussed last week, to keep Ukraine going as a even a credible pretense of a protagonist in the war up until the U.S. election. So something more important has to be done. And there's a lot of murmuring going on in European capitals about Ukraine pulling back to the Dnieper River. And there have been articles published among the mainstream media saying, oh, well, perhaps we should, the best we can hope for is a ceasefire line or armistice along the Dnieper, freezing of the conflict, and then we can arm West Ukraine, which is the most Ukrainian-speaking part of Ukraine, and ditch the Russian part, and then there'll be a Cold War. And of course, Cold War is, I think, the only fallback option available to the U.S. and the EU, short of allowing a total Ukrainian collapse, which would be a debacle. And when that headline trumpeted, Ukraine defeat will cost trillions, actually, it's the reverse. Continued Ukrainian resistance will cost trillions. But those trillions, in the form of meeting the demands of a new Cold War, would have the wonderful sort of byproduct effect of strengthening the authority of the ruling establishments in Brussels, the EU, and in Washington, in the US, because it would create a kind of ongoing forever crisis, which is essentially what the Cold War was between 1950 and 1990, and create a situation where European and then, of course, American establishment rulers are beleaguered by their own electorates and are under increasing pressure, whether it's France, Germany, the Netherlands, and, of course, especially the U.S. And
we have 1 minute, Germanicus.
Yeah, the only way to hold that or stave that off is to create a crisis that also brings in its wake tremendous anxiety among electorates. And they're scared out of their minds. And then they say, yes, you do what you have to do. Do what you have to do to deter Russia from advancing any farther across the Dnieper. So, I mean, that may be the thinking. It's magical thinking. It's a fantasy. And it's highly likely to escalate. But that I think is becoming the fallback option short of admitting defeat.
Before the election. Everything's before the election. Is that correct, Germanicus?
Yes, because I think my sense, and it's only a sensation, but it's a sensation honed by studying war for 60 years, that there is a point where things begin to break and then things happen fast. You know, like the old Great Gatsby, slowly and then suddenly. And in that, if that is actually the situation right now, then Ukraine can't hold on to the U.S. election. And that puts the U.S. establishment and NATO establishments in the position of desperation, because they don't want to be unseated. They don't want to lose power.
Let's move to NATO. Germanicus and I, our avatars in the 20th century, were recruited into NATO auxiliaries as teenagers. This is the Friends of History Debating Society. I'm Gaius. He's Germanicus. We're in Londinium. It's a calm and coming May afternoon. The centurions and their families were shopping. They've gone on home for dinner. We senior Romans are enjoying our cup of wine. We have no special need to rush on to dinner. We are going to the theater later. Exciting tonight is going to be a pantomime of scenes from The Golden Ass, our favorite novel next to Satyricon. We are Romans. This is the Friends of History Debating Society. I'm John Batchelor.